You are Locked On Mets, your daily New York Mets podcast. Part of the Locked On Podcast Network, your team every day.
Hello to all you amazing Mets fans. You're listening to Locked On Mets, part of the Locked On Podcast Network, your team every day. To get this show every day, I need you to subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. Also, don't forget to tell your smart device to play podcast Locked On Mets. Now, this week, we are celebrating the 1986 World Champion New York Mets team. And on today's show, I was joined by Brian Wright, the author of New York Mets All-Time All-Stars, to talk about two of the All-Stars the Mets brought in that made that team a real championship contender. In the first half of the show, you will hear us talking about Keith Hernandez, and then later on in the second half, you'll hear us talk about Gary Carter. Before we get into any of that, though, I'm your host, Ryan Finkelstein. If you want to find any of my work, check me out on Twitter, at FinkelsteinRyan. You can also find some of my writing about the Mets at MetsMerizedOnline.com. So without further ado, here is my conversation with Brian Wright about Keith Hernandez and Gary Carter. All right, Mets fans, very happy to once again be joined by Brian Wright, the author of the New York Mets All-Time All-Stars, Best Players at Every Position for the Amazons, here to talk a little bit about that 1986 Mets team with me. Thanks for joining me again, Brian.
Hey, great to be on again, Ryan.
So I want to focus on Keith Hernandez and Gary Carter today because those two trades really were the finishing touches, the accelerators to what made that 1986 Mets team go. And the first acquisition they made was acquiring Keith Hernandez. And as you noted in the book, he was a decorated World Series champion at that point with the St. Louis Cardinals, had an MVP to his name, Silver Slugger, 5 Gold Gloves, 2 All-Star appearances. Can you explain to me, you said that was the best trade in Mets history. Why was that the best trade, along with what it took to get him, which really wasn't much?
Yeah, I mean, it was the best trade because of, I think, what happened afterwards. I mean, there's a difference between when the Mets, before the Mets got Keith Hernandez, and afterwards. Certainly the rest of the 83 season, they got him in June of 83, certainly the rest of the 83 season didn't go very well, but there was a definite change in culture noticeable in 84 when the Mets won 90 games with him at first base and obviously Dwight Gooden coming in and being the star pitcher at 19 years old. After they traded Tom Seaver in 1977, I mean, the Chase Stadium was just a dead zone, you know, a downtrodden franchise, to say the least. I mean, they were last or next to last for all those years. And Frank Cashin came in as the GM in 1980. He had drafted Daryl Strawberry, number one, in 1980, drafted Dwight Gooden, had kind of built up a farm system that was completely barren at one point. But the team, in order to get back to respectability, had to get a respected veteran. And Keith Hernandez was that kind of player. There was rumors when he was with the Cardinals that proved to be true that he was using cocaine. And it's been said that Whitey Herzog, the manager of the Cardinals, not only didn't approve of that, but it was kind of, they just had a lot of friction between the two. So that helped. That gave the Mets a lot of leverage when they wanted to make the deal for Keith Hernandez at the trade deadline, the trade deadline used to be in June, the trade deadline in 1983, and the Mets gave up Neil Allen, who was a good relief pitcher for the Mets, and a Rick Owenby, who, as it turned out, did not have much left after he left the Mets. He had not built any reputation and didn't have any afterwards, and Neil Allen was not the same pitcher when he left the Mets and went to the Cardinals. So it was the aftermath and what it resulted in that led to it being the greatest trade. I mean, Keith Hernandez not only was just a clutch hitter, number three hitter, RBI, you know, drove a lot of RBIs, drove a lot of runs, I should say, respectable batting average, fantastic fielder, but he was the unquestioned leader on the field and kind of, you know, helped with the young pitchers, just kind of changed the attitude of the Mets. And that was so badly needed for a team that had no respect. He gave them that respect. And that helped them along in 84, down the line through the championship year of 86.
Yeah, and the thing that I didn't realize before reading the book was that Keith Hernandez could have left the Mets. I mean, he was a free agent. I know at the time, free agency wasn't quite like it is now, where you see as much movement. But Keith could have decided, you know what, I don't want to stick with this Mets team. And also, it's kind of similar, just comparing the two, to how the Mets acquired Mike Piazza, where they make the trade to get him, and then they have to convince him to stay. What was it that kept Keith around and, you know, obviously resulted in what was an incredible career with the Mets?
Yeah, so after that half season with the Mets, he was not – I mean, even at first, he was – Keith Hernandez was not too pleased about joining the Mets and contemplated even just retiring. Even after that first half season, didn't want to stay. And both Frank Cashin and Rusty Staub, the veteran presence on the Mets, kind of convinced Keith about not only the prospects that they had in line, like Daryl Strawberry, who had just come up, of course, and Dwight Gooden, who was coming up, and Ron Darling, who was on the way up, but also just about just being, and Rusty Staub specifically kind of convinced him that just playing in New York and kind of the benefit of being in that kind of environment. So Keith bought in, of course, and the rest is Mets history, as we all know.
Yeah, and so he buys in the 1984. You mentioned the Mets jump from 68 to 90 wins, and he was second in MVP voting that year. I know the Mets also had Daryl Strawberry and Doc Gooden, and you know those prospects really started to reach the surface. But how important was it to have that captain kind of leading the charge and producing at an unbelievable level?
It was so important. I mean, Dwight Gooden was a phenomenal pitcher, a phenomenon to say the least, but you know, a 19-year-old pitcher isn't going to carry an entire team. They need someone, an everyday player, to do that. And Keith was the guy who provided that everyday leadership. Yeah, second in MVP. I mean, he batted .311. His OPS plus was 143. I don't have it in front of me as far as war, but I think he had the best on the team. I wouldn't have to imagine he did. And again, an everyday player. He was out there all the time. He was communicating with other players, communicating with the pitchers. That was Keith's best year as a Met by far. Just the way that he helped take that team from, you know, 60 some wins to 90 wins and to a second place finish is really remarkable.
And before I kind of switch over to Gary Carter, a couple more questions about Keith Hernandez and his overall career impact on the Mets. 11 straight Gold Gloves. And I think when you look at Hall of Fame, it's really, to me, shocking that, especially nowadays, the Veterans Committee hasn't really taken a bigger look into that defense and that value that he brought his teams. Is it stunning to you, as it is to me, that he's not in the Hall of Fame? And how incredible was he defensively at first base in a way that we really haven't seen since?
Yeah. I think he changed the reputation he also expanded the possibilities for a first baseman. I think most teams, when they would put a first baseman on the field, it would usually be some lumbering power hitter that they could just stick there. Keith Hernandez kind of made it a position of possibility on defense, a way to limit runs. I think sometimes before that day, teams would put a first baseman just to like make sure they weren't a liability on defense. And Keith Hernandez made it where he could help the defense. He could be an asset. He would make aggressive plays on bunts and throw to second base if they were trying to advance a runner from first to second, or you know, if there were runners on first and second and they're trying to advance a runner to third, he would throw it to third. And that was just something the first baseman really hadn't done. And he was also had that great range at first base as well. So yeah, he's by far the greatest defensive first baseman. To say I'm shocked that he's not gotten in is, I wouldn't say shocked. I wouldn't be surprised if the committees who now vote on the Hall of Fame eventually get around to him. I think, and this is a good thing, I think we've now looked at how important defense is. I think back when he was eligible for the Hall of Fame, there wasn't that as much focus on defensive abilities and runs saved and war and all that. And I think we are coming around to that point where you look at it a little closer and see the value of a player of his nature and say, hey, you know, he didn't hit a lot of home runs. He had a very good batting average, but his fielding was so important and to the team that maybe we should look at him a little closer. I don't like to say, be one of those, if this guy is in, then this guy should be in. But when I see it, there's a couple players I compare Keith Hernandez to, not because they're alike, but also because of their, of what they brought and kind of what they're known for. I mean, Bill Mazeroski made the Hall of Fame, I believe, in 2001, probably the greatest defensive second baseman ever, and is known for that home run, game-winning home run in 1960 to beat the Yankees to help the Pirates win the World Series. I think he won 7 gold gloves. Keith won, as we said, 11, is the greatest defensive first baseman. Doesn't have the game-ending clutch hit, but he did not only provide the clutch hit in Game 7 of the 86 World Series that brought the Mets from down 3-0 to 3-2, but in the 82 series with the Cardinals, had a very similar situation in which he came through. I believe it tied the game. I think it was the sixth or seventh inning against Milwaukee. So he has 2 big hits that helped his respective teams win the World Series. So if I'm going to draw a comparison to someone else, I might draw it to Bill Mazeroski. And also, I mean, we see guys like Harold Baines. With all due respect to Harold Baines, very good player. I would have never thought he would make the Hall of Fame. So if we're allowing guys like Harold Baines in, maybe we should look at Keith Hernandez.
I want to transition into talking about Gary Carter, because that was really kind of the finishing touch. When you bring in Gary Carter, the team really took off. 1985, everything starts to click for the Mets. They end up winning 98 games. That is the 4th most in franchise history and the most to ever not result in a playoff berth. So, first off, how does Frank Cashin pull off the trade to get what was at the time arguably the best catcher in baseball?
I don't have it right in front of me, but I believe he knew someone with the Expos who kind of made it known to him that Gary Carter was on the market. I think Carter had signed, I don't want to say a long-term deal, but I think he had signed a deal with the Expos to stay there, and kind of a surprise that the Expos were willing to let him go because he was so beloved in Montreal. And the Mets had very few weaknesses on the 84 team, but one of them was catcher. I mean, Mike Fitzgerald was a serviceable catcher, but he certainly didn't even come close to the caliber of a Gary Carter. So to get him, he would have been remarkable, and they pulled it off. Now they had to get rid of not only Fitzgerald, but also Hubie Brooks, who was a very likable third baseman, a very good third baseman for the Mets. They also gave up Floyd Yeomans, a pitcher, and also I'm trying to remember who else they gave up in that trade. I'd have to actually look it up, but there might be one more player. Yeah, it was a very surprising move. I mean, I don't think anyone saw it coming. Frank Cashin may not have saw it coming unless someone told him about it, but that was, you pointed out, kind of really the last big piece, the building of that championship team. I mean, obviously took not only 85, but also 86 to make it happen. But 85, as you said, 98 wins, and Gary Carter was probably the most valuable everyday player to that team. Gooden, of course, ascended to another level on the mound. But Carter, with his bat, especially in September, really brought them back into that pennant race with the Cardinals, even though they came up a little bit short.
Gary Carter really helped foster that young pitching staff that was just kind of coming into their own when he gets there. How important was that side of Gary Carter? Obviously, the home runs and the production offensively is incredible for a catcher, but being able to be that veteran leader for a young pitching staff, what did that do for those Mets teams?
It really matured them quickly on the mound. I mean, with not only Gooden, but Ron Darling, Sid Fernandez, those are 3 very important pitchers that season, kind of helped them get a little bit older and wiser as far as their pitching experience is concerned that season. Gooden with the remarkable season, probably the best pitching season in Mets history. Darling had a very good year as well. They didn't have as much pitching as they would in 86, but Keith Hernandez provided that guidance from first base. Carter provided it behind the plate, which in all due respect is a little more important. Of course, if you're having a good catcher that can kind of mold the pitching staff. So, I mean, that was very important to the fate of the Mets. Down the stretch, they didn't have enough pitching, but with Carter there, it made that pitching staff that much better. I don't know if a catcher of less caliber would have been as effective to guys like Gooden and Darling, and maybe they would, maybe the Mets would not have been in the race without Carter.
And then you mentioned the book 1986 comes around, and really a lot of the guys didn't have their best years, but it was just the collective, you know, overabundance of talent top to bottom on the roster that they didn't need, you know, an 85 Gooden performance or Gary Carter to do exactly what he did in 85 and a lot of those other guys to produce at that incredible level. But still at the same time, you had those two veteran superstars in Keith Hernandez and Gary Carter. How did they kind of share that burden of leadership in 1986, resulting in that amazing regular season into the playoffs?
Carter and Hernandez were the obvious leaders. Carter was more outspoken, but he was just obviously a more visible presence, where Hernandez was a little more, I wouldn't say reserved, but he wasn't that kind of the personality that Carter was. He would always be in front of the camera, where Hernandez was a little more cerebral. But they split it pretty well, I think, as far as on-field leadership. They obviously had that reputation as far as the team was concerned. The team had the reputation of being very wild. And a guy like Carter, who is religious and not that type of person, I don't know if he could control those players like a Strawberry or Gooden off the field. So that was hard to do. But I think on the field, they did it very well. Again, it was very balanced. I mean, Carter had over 100 RBIs and was the only player on the team to do it. Hernandez batted .310, was, I think, second on the team in among starters in batting average. I think Wally Backman had a little bit better. And Daryl Strawberry had very good year. I mean, he had 27 home runs, 93 RBIs, but had not emerged into the superstar that we all thought he was going to just yet. So yeah, it was nothing like, hey, this guy like really, really stood out and was the dominant force. I mean, it took contributions from everyone and really no one, not many disappointed. I mean, George Foster was the guy, only real guy that was a starter that didn't turn out to be as good as anyone thought or that year, and they cut him, but pretty much everyone played to their role, played to their level at least.
And that brings you into the playoffs where, you know, to get to the Red Sox, the Mets had to go through the Astros, but I just kind of want to talk about both those series in a general sense. And, you know, I think you kind of read the book, and obviously Gary Carter and Keith Hernandez, both at certain points of that playoff run, you know, went through some struggles, but ultimately they each came through in different ways. You mentioned Keith's big hit. Also kind of just talk about some of the big moments that those two guys delivered throughout the playoffs.
Well, yeah, as far as the LCS was concerned, Carter really struggled up until game five. I think he was 1-for-21 going into that at bat in game five in the 12th inning. And he came through with the single against Charlie Kerfeld that drove in Wally Backman to win that game. But before that, like I said, had really done next to nothing. Hernandez had a little bit better series. I mean, he had a triple in game two that led to a run. And in game six, in which the Mets really had to win that game, Mike Scott, the ace of the Astros staff, was not only dominating them on the mound, but he was really in their heads. The Mets thought that he was scuffing the baseball, which he probably was. That's how dominant he was. If they had not won game six, they'd have to face him in game seven. They had lost to him in games one and four. And who knows? It's highly doubtful that they would have pulled off a game seven victory against Scott. So they were down 3-0 in the ninth inning of game six. Lenny Dykstra gets a triple. Mookie Wilson drives him in. Then Hernandez comes up, and I believe Hernandez hadn't gotten hit all day, comes through with a double that scores Mookie Wilson, brings him within 3-2. So that's a huge way to build the momentum and eventually leads to the tie score. And about seven innings later, the Mets pull off the victory in 16 innings. So they both had their moments in that LCS and then in the World Series. Carter came to life a little bit more. He hits the two home runs in game four, and then, of course, gets the hit in the bottom of the 10th inning that sustains the Mets temporarily and leads eventually to the game six victory. And then Hernandez, as I talked about earlier, big game seven hit. And after that hit, Carter comes through with a hit that's, you know, looks like a line drive in the box score. It winds up being a little blooper that falls in front of Dwight Evans and ties the game. So they had their moments there. I think their leadership really came through in the fact that what I talked about earlier is that everyone kind of had a great year. I think that's also a credit to Carter and Hernandez being those leaders that keeps the rest of the players up every day and does not let them get down and maybe lose their focus on the field.
I think it's very clear at this point when you look back on the history of that 1986 Mets, while the team was great and there was an incredible collection of young talent, the championship does not happen if it's not for those two guys coming in. So anyway, that will be all for today. So why don't you tell the people where they can find your book and your work in general?
Yeah, they can find my book, New York Mets All-Time All-Stars, on any online retailer, Amazon, Barnes & Noble, also independent bookstore, online bookstores. They do sell them as well. If you want a signed copy from me, you can reach me at my Twitter handle, at BrianWright86. And also I write for Metsmerized. I just had a piece on the 2000 opening series in Japan as part of our retrospective 20 years later on the 2000 National League Championship team. So look for my work at Metsmerized.
Awesome. Thanks again for joining me.
Thanks, Ryan. Appreciate it.
That'll be all for today's edition of Locked On Mets. We will continue to talk about the 1986 team on tomorrow's show. I'm going to go through the regular season and talk about some of the best stories and how the Mets were able to come away with the best record in the National League. Then throughout the rest of the week, we'll be talking a little bit about the playoffs, the NLCS against the Astros, and then ultimately, of course, the World Series against the Boston Red Sox. Thank you for listening, and also please don't forget to tell your smart device to play podcast Locked On Mets.